All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. And as Edwin Starr just said, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. The guest is Sandy Williams. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, here's something I wanted to talk about, and the unpalatable truth in Ukraine. This is by Andrew Lathan. He's an opinion contributor to The Hill. Let me repeat that. The unpalatable truth in Ukraine. And the truth is, once we have eliminated all the impossible scenarios, the least improbable outcome of the war in Ukraine is a Russian victory. Note that I did not say such an outcome would be desirable. Russia's inevitable victory is anything but, nor did I say it would be total. The outcome of this war is going to fall far short of the Kremlin's initial hopes and expectations, nor finally did I say it would be without significant cost. Any conceivable Russian victory now will entail such a loss of blood and treasure that it will have to be judged. It will be a victory nonetheless, and we in the West had better come to grips with that hard truth. That sounds like you.
Well, I did. You know, I do.
And
think,
you said that.
I think the horror of this is going to settle in with historians when they go back, and if historians can look at it on in an unbiased way and just say, okay, why did this happen, and was it avoidable, and what was the outcome of it? Because, it has to do with this concept of hegemony, of the sphere of influence of powerful countries. The United States, our Secretary of State Blinken talked about how this was the end of the period of hegemony, and a country like Russia isn't entitled to a sphere of influence. But of course, the United States is exercising its sphere of influence widely and broadly,
right,
much to the consternation of much of the rest of the world, who talks about this kind of big bully approach we have to going around the world and telling people how to manage themselves. And so this whole disturbance is really the result of the United States deciding to ignore and deny that Russia, this very strong, militarily strong country, was not entitled to what was a natural geopolitical sphere of influence, which would include Ukraine. Now, if we had left Ukraine to its own devices, it probably would be in much the same position as Georgia, a neighboring country who's got a strong alliance with Russia, is actually prospering better than Russia in terms of it has many dealings with the West. We aren't reading daily about our concerns about personal individual liberties in Georgia. They have a government that's closer to the old Soviet system, but it's not doing badly. And so Ukraine could have been like that, but we decided to arm Ukraine and to give it false hopes that they would maybe be in NATO, and we gave them the Dutch courage to not negotiate with Russia, to give Russia what it wanted, which was promises of neutrality, promises that it wouldn't join NATO, promises of the kind of a relationship with Russia that would give Russia comfort about the situation. And so... then when Russia surrounded Ukraine in December, January, Ukraine wasn't willing to negotiate the things that Russia was essentially wanting. And what they wanted was a recognition of the Crimea annexation by Ukraine, so that it would be recognized by the world that Ukraine and Sevastopol was actually a part of Russia. And they wanted to clarify the situation in the Donbas. And when Ukraine was unwilling to talk about those apparently at all, Russia decided that they needed to do something militarily. And so, you know, is that a violation of international law? Yes. But is it because of this lack of recognition of the hegemony of Russia? Yes. Because if we had left Ukraine to its own devices, not armed it, not given it this false hope, they would have negotiated with Russia and a solution would have been reached. And we could have probably been comfortable with it. But we decided that that wasn't going to be the way it would play out, and now it hasn't played out that way. Is the result of this war going to be pretty much what I described? I think it is. I think what this fellow is writing about is the unpalatable truth is that Crimea will be annexed by Russia. It will be the recognition of that will occur. There will be a recognition of the status of Donbass as being different and probably autonomous from Ukraine. And all of that has occurred with the unbelievable destruction of Ukraine and its infrastructure, the killing of many, many people, the killing of many Russians, for that matter, the exhaustion by Russia of many of its resources. Now, are we worried about that? Not so much. But we should worry about the ultimate outcome, which is going to be the resegregation of the world, the reestablishment of an Iron Curtain, the recompartmentalization of the world, the potential for creating the hostility or latent hostility in the world, which will drive a new Cold War that has no rules associated with it, and a $1 trillion-plus U.S. defense budget, which will deprive the American people of child daycare and will deprive them of health care for all, and that it will exhaust the treasure of the United States in a way that didn't need to happen.
You know, Sandy, I saw something, read something the other day, and it was pro-America, and it was talking about that whole sector and the power of that sector has now swung more to, you know, to NATO and the United States. There's been this power shift since Russia went into Ukraine because now we're stronger now. Because we've got these other nations that have willing to agree. And so, in other words, we're going to supplant Russia's power
in
that region.
Well, stronger for what purpose?
That's my point. Yeah, but to say those things, Sandy.
Well, what worries me a lot about this is that, you know, we talk about the Ukraine. We have to fight this because if we didn't fight this, China, what will China do with Taiwan? Well, Taiwan situation is even more remarkably like Ukraine, and it's not because of this potential for warfare. It's because of this ambiguity of the U.S. policy towards Taiwan and this kind of Dutch courage that we've created. We've armed Taiwan, but we've also agreed to a one-China policy. We've agreed to strategic ambiguity, and we know that we don't want to put troops on the ground or we're not going to put our airplanes in the air to fight on behalf of Taiwan. And so, but we're creating a circumstance in which we're arming Taiwan to the point where are they going to be willing to negotiate with China about how China's relationship with Taiwan is ultimately clarified? Because we all have agreed already that China has sovereignty over the island of Taiwan.
So Sandy, what this guy is talking about is what you've been talking about. And it doesn't matter how much more money America puts in the kitty, the outcome of what's going to happen in Ukraine is already predicted. So when do the American people say, hey, enough already?
Well, in fact, here's an analogy. It's a little bit like the gun problem in America. When you bring swords to an argument, you'll have a sword fight.
Right.
When you bring guns to an argument, you'll have a gunfight. When you bring weaponry and military alliances to a diplomatic conversation, you'll have a war. And so that's what worries me about what's happening now is we've decided to lean in the direction of NATO rather than the EU. Okay, the EU is related to NATO. EU is the mercantile analogy to it, but if we've decided to emphasize NATO, then we've essentially, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what Putin has been talking about is the danger that NATO is really a military thrust by an alliance which is essentially part of the American empire. Well, that's the way we're kind of talking now.
Well, yeah, because I was listening to Zelensky the other day, and he was saying, look, we're the threshold to Russia entering into Europe. And if you don't do something to help us, the next move is going to be Europe. Well, That's a hell of a jump, right?
Well, that's the mirror image of what Putin was saying. Putin was saying Ukraine is the first step on an invasion into Russia. And if NATO is established in Ukraine, then isn't that step one to essentially a destruction of the Russian Federation? And so this kind of talk, this kind of paranoid prediction of the future that everything is a domino for the next thing, is the way we get into major wars.
And we're you know, buying, and you still believe negotiations are going to be, it's only been 100 days. And that's easy for me to say, right? I don't live in Ukraine. But saying it's only been 100 days, it's probably been like 100 years to those people. Right.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and it the fighting is getting worse, as everybody predicted. Once it warmed up and the ground wars.
Well, and also once it shifted to the Donbas, which is an entirely different geographic terrain, is the kind of thing that is open to, particularly tank warfare and artillery warfare. Yep.
But now it's hand to hand. Basically combat, and so that's why so many people are dying.
Well,
I got to go to a break. Hold the thought. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And you know, listen, we have no choice but to talk about what other people don't want to talk about. Just because people don't want to talk about what's happening with Ukraine doesn't mean it's not happening, right? I mean, we're talking about this, Sandy, not to make people feel bad. We're talking about this because this is the real world, and we're involved in it. And whether people want to think that we're not, because after it's all said and done, Sandy, is this our war? I mean, we act as though this is our war.
Well, you know, it's not our war in terms of, we've definitely declared up front and whatever that we're not going to put ourselves, put our blood at risk. We might put some treasure at risk, but we're not going to put our blood at risk. But in many respects, what we've done leading up to this has caused us to be a potential source of the tension that has caused the war. So I would assert that American foreign policy helped develop the context in which this war is now carried out. War is an awful thing, and it doesn't belong. It doesn't belong in the conduct of proper human relations. But unfortunately, in history, it's a common reoccurring occurrence in human relations, and we should have taken that into account in the kind of policies we adopted. But we adopted a policy that gave Ukraine the false courage to not negotiate with Russia, in whose sphere of influence they clearly lie. And as a result of that, we end up with this outcome. This is a predictable outcome in the grand scheme of things. If a historians look back at time, they would say this is a predictable outcome. And the outcome is horrid. And you can see it because of the reality of this dystopic occurrence that's now Ukraine, the rubble everywhere, cities like Mariupol destroyed, people, 10 million immigrants leaving Ukraine, lots of people dislocated, hunger being created not only in Ukraine but around the world. This was predictable. And we're doing it because of what? because of the spread of democracy, that doesn't really sell when you've also got the President of the United States heading over to Saudi Arabia, or the Secretary of State, or whoever it is that's going to go and negotiate with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, a country which is not democratic at all. Or we look at all the other countries that we've decided to have as our bedfellows, whose the plight of whose individuals, the people in those countries, is no better or worse than the situation in either Ukraine or Russia, and similarly China.
So, Sam, who do we have on the line? Oh, okay. So let me say this to you, Sandy. How long can we go on with one foot in and one foot out? At some point in time, we're going to become more involved to the degree that we can't get the one foot out that we have in.
Well, we're almost there, because we're now transferring and selling these rockets to Ukraine, which have a 48 to 50 mile guided ballistic. Yeah. Length of potential use, which could send them into Russia. And so we're requiring that Ukraine announce that they will never use these to fire into Russian soil to satisfy Russia that we're not giving them offensive weapons. But as time goes on, and as the, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky just indicated that the numbers in the battlefield in the Donbas are essentially seven Russians to every Ukrainian. They're overmanned. And the fact is that Donbas is essentially in Russian control today, and so either there's going to be a negotiated settlement that would end up with that kind of a result, or Ukraine is going to need to be armed with something more than they've got, and it's undoubtedly going to need to be more than these 50-mile radius rockets that we're sending them. So when it comes time to actually arm them to do something more than the current circumstance, which is a slow defeat to Russia, we're going to start putting 2 feet into this battle.
You know, Sandy, when you just tie all the loose ends together, the fact that is going to get worse, because Russia is not going to back down. They say that they are there to the end. They've made this commitment, and that they are not going to go back. So whatever it is they have decided that they want it, they are not going to stop. And Russia will continue in Ukraine until all goals achieved. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has been speaking with reporters at his regular briefing, where he said Russia will continue its military operation in Ukraine until all goals have been achieved, period.
Right.
I don't know if when they're speaking like that, Sandy.
Well, you know, like I said off the air, both sides are also in the process of sort of a shadow negotiation. So union and management often speak publicly in a very dogmatic way, and privately they have some flex. And in this circumstance, I think, however, that it's been clear all along what Russia essentially needs and wants, which is Crimea annexation and the settlement somehow of the situation in the Donbas. And that's what's going to be required, as well as neutrality of Ukraine. And we've known that since the country was encircled by Russian troops and not yet invaded. And the question is Ukraine in a position to agree to that? And they've already sent the signal, Zelensky has, that he's willing to be neutral. He's willing to promise never to join NATO. Those were two of the things that are required. He's also said that it's unlikely, they've said, but they don't assert, that it's unlikely that they would be able to recover all of that property, all of that land, meaning Crimea. And the rest of the world, the allies, have all basically indicated that they're not sure they're willing to continue to equip Ukraine with weapons for the purpose of regaining Crimea, which Right. would be a major and different offensive war rather than the one that they're in. And so I do believe that all the talk today is talk that surrounds an armistice and a settlement. And the question is just when will this settlement occur? And when will America and the allies who are arming Ukraine begin to let Ukraine know that, you know, you're going to need to settle this because we're not going to keep escalating the weapons we're going to send you.
So the allies, they certainly can't withstand the continuation of sending weapons.
And Putin is sort of right that the sanctions, particularly the sanction that cuts Russian oil off from Europe, put some fissures, at least cracks, in the alliance. Hungary and some of the countries who really rely on Russian oil, we're going to have to suffer pretty substantial consequences in their economy by not continuing to take Russian oil.
All right, we've got to go to a break. Phone lines are open, 844-967-2789. Sandy Williams is here. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789 in Texas, that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I was saying to you off the air about these. Our NATO allies can't continue. They can't afford to continue to send these weapons. And even if you added all of their weapons up, their weaponry up that they're sending, you know, they clearly don't come close to what we're sending. And you stated so aptly, man, and we don't even think about it, that $800 million military budget.
$800 billion
is going to soon, next time around, it'll be a trillion. And we can say, well, listen, we depleted all our weapons. We need to have all of these arms that we would use ourselves.
Well, and we have to stiffen our ability to fight a war with China.
Yeah, ourselves, right.
And we have to be able to stiffen our ability to have a war with Russia. And so, there's no question that they're setting, the table has been set for $1 trillion a year defense budget based on the circumstance that's being created out of all this. And that's a huge domestic detriment, huge.
Well, the GDP is not growing to that degree, so they're going to take it from somewhere else, as you stated.
Yeah, particularly if we slip into a stagflated recession. Recession means the GDP is actually falling. So it's not growing, so that would become an increasing percentage of a decreasing number. And with the deglobalization of the world economy, that also will have a long-term recessionary effect, not a growth opportunity, but a recessionary effect. So if the outcome of the Ukraine hostility is to recompartmentalize the world, to deglobalize it, the deglobalized economy will have a lower growth rate than a globalized economy. That's one of the clear historical facts of globalization, is the world economy grew at a faster rate than it ever had, and a big driver of that was China. Well, are we going to try and decompartmentalize from China? Because we talk like that, that will be exceedingly difficult.
Let me ask you, Sandy, this is a horrible time and difficult time it would have been for any president. All these different things happening. I don't care who the president was, some of the former presidents, this would be a difficult time for any of them with all the different confluences of things that are happening. Joe Biden, how much more of this can the poor guy take?
Yeah,
well, I mean we have to really, Sandy, we look at him and he's fragile. Anybody who looks at him knows he's fragile. And so it's one thing after another, after another, after another. And I was watching him last night as he was talking about, you know, what we have to do with guns. He really is a sensitive guy. I mean, when you look at the tragedies in his own life and what he's had to deal with his son, with his first wife and children dying in the automobile. I mean, he's gone through an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is having to try to hold all of this up at the time that he's being attacked and assaulted. He hasn't been the president for a full 2 years yet. How much more can he take?
Well, and the thing is, what we really need is strong leadership and someone who can maybe shift the direction of the United States in more positive ways. He might have those instincts, but the question is, does he have the charisma and the capacity of leadership?
Not now.
And who is on the horizon who does? And, you know, because, you know, what we keep talking about America and the problems it's got, and I wouldn't deny the fact that I do believe we have many, many problems, and we have some real societal problems, and the only way to get out of it is to shift course. You know, this aircraft carrier of a country needs to have its direction changed, and that will require very strong leadership, and not the kind of leadership that Donald Trump provided, because that was not going to change the direction of the aircraft carrier in any positive way. So, you know, I just think that we need America, because we need to understand the huge impact we have on the world. Our flirtations in Eurasia with Ukraine has caused a huge problem, and it's almost like collateral damage from inadvertent conduct. It's almost collateral damage from the bravado that we use for our domestic conversations with one another. It's almost collateral damage from the tomfoolery we have when we use American exceptionalism as the basis for everything we talk about and do within America and maybe abroad. And you know, we are in the process of stirring the pot in some very difficult negative ways, and we need to have leadership that can recognize that. And I'm afraid that our current political environment generally just doesn't show me that there's people there to do it.
So you just, you know, hit on where I was going. Is any of that possible with the divide that gets bigger and bigger every day between the two parties? I mean, at a time when we do need to have an agreement with both sides that this change needs to occur. It can't be one side saying we're the ones with the answer to this.
Well,
the other side doesn't know. Look at what they've done, and pointing the fingers.
Well, look at this. The whole show, I think, has been a discussion of problems that relate to the lack of courageous political leadership. Is this sacredness of guns anything but the result of political weakness and leadership weakness? Because everybody privately would agree that it's crazy that we have 400 million guns in the hands of Americans, of civilians, that we have 20 million assault rifles, 50,000 machine guns out there in the hands of civilians. Everyone would agree that that is not an outcome that should exist, but there aren't any political leaders willing to stick their head up above the foxhole and talk like that. Okay, and the same is true with respect to our foreign policy or our defense budget, and so the problems we have in America today, in many respects, are the result of no political leadership. People in politics
on either side.
On either side, people in politics who only stick their finger up and measure the wind. And that's what they do.
Who do we have on the line, Sam?
Dave is calling from Milwaukee.
Hey, Dave, how you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what, my friend?
I'm doing great. Good morning. I just wanted to call in to say that one cannot have a clear perspective of what's going on in Ukraine with Russia and America's involvement in all of that without reading two resources. One is Gangsters of Capitalism by Jonathan Katz. It's about the story of Smedley Butler's life. Who he entered the Marines. He lied about his age. He became a Marine at age 16 in the late 1800s. And he was involved in Cuba, Nicaragua, China, Philippines, Panama, Haiti, to name a few, in overthrowing those governments and raiding those countries and installing friendly American leaders in those countries. The other resource one should know about, and I'm sure we've all heard about this, but I really didn't pay much attention to it until, this invasion. And that is the Project for a New American Century. And to sum that up, what that is, that was a project by high-level neocons, including Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and those types, proposing the world would be better if America totally dominated the world, and that our foreign policy should be moving in that direction.
That's Pax Americana, right?
Yeah. But this book, this Gangsters of Capitalism, was amazing because the author, Jonathan Katz, got access. Okay, Butler was a prolific letter writer. He was a Quaker, very religious. He joined the Marines to make America safe for democracy, and three-quarters of the way into his career, murdering and killing his way through the world, he had a change of heart, and he called himself a gangster of capitalism, hence the title of the book. And he resented a lot of the assignments that he was given. But what's amazing is he was a prolific letter writer, and the author got access to the letters from the family, from the Butler family. And so you get insight into his evolution from being, this really patriotic, making the world safe for democracy with, America dominating everything, to, his change and what caused him to change position. He also, of note, is
quickly.
He was recruited to do a coup on FDR. It's called the business plot. This is not a conspiracy theory. There were congressional investigations. It's public record. It's just been lost in history.
So thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. Sandy, we've got to face some hard truths about our country.
Yeah.
There are many Americans who don't want to face that. Well, and for the life of me, I don't, and every day I come in here, I try to get people to look at the truth about what's happening, and they don't want to, right? I mean, it's like kids, I don't like oatmeal, I'm not eating it.
It's this American exceptionalism and our domestic sort of arrogance, the notion that we can't be imperfect and still be exceptional. We can't meet all of the standards we've set for America if we have imperfections, and so we ignore them. It's like narcissism. It's like malignant narcissism on an international basis.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Back to the last last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show. You know, Sandy Mann, I just, you know, the depth of the conversations that we have, and the fact, Sandy, that we're willing to have, and as you stated last Wednesday, and we both know, this is what makes the nation what it is, the fact that we can talk like you and I are talking, right? Without reprisal. Nobody's going to come in and kick the doors in and say, you know, these guys are anti-Americans.
Although Colin Kaepernick might
argue
about that a little bit.
Yeah. But
it's not the government.
No. And so the American people, so many of us kind of like have, you know, blinders on. And it takes some thought outside of our own personal lives to really think about our government, where it's going, what it's doing, and that there's a whole world that we're a part of. Right? It's easy to say, like you say, exceptionalism, where Americans were exceptional. And many of us live inside of the American bubble. Like, we're the only people on the planet. Well, it's not going to fly anymore.
Yes, and when our American exceptionalism keeps us from doing a self-examination that maybe causes us to ignore some serious problems we have inside our country, it also causes us to ignore and to not understand what's going on in the rest of the world as it reacts to us. Because it is true in a way that when we sneeze, the rest of the world catches a cold. But the fact is that that much of what we do is much more than sneezing. It's an overt extension of this view of ourselves, of American exceptionalism, this view that we can basically tell the rest of the world what to do and how to do it because we are an exceptional influence. It's almost a godlike self-image.
You know, Sandy, how many times I've had people say to me, well, Earl, you know, if you don't like it, you should leave. You don't know how many times I've had people say to me, well, if our country is such a bad place, why are people from all over the world trying to get in here? And I said, I never said that it was such a bad place. And I understand. I wouldn't want, nowhere else in the world I'd rather live.
America, love it or leave it. You and I were, you know, when I was in college, that was a refrain for the people who wanted to question the
Vietnam War, right?
And it became the same refrain during the Iraq War. You know, you have to toe the line, apparently. You can't question our foreign policy. And yet our foreign policy has such a huge impact on us individually inside our domestic economy because of, you know, if we're going to spend $1 trillion a year on defense, on our cost of the military environment that we have, then we need to understand what it is we can't spend money on, because the fact is we all have to understand the United States government cannot simply print money for the purpose of carrying out its military expenditures. It comes from a pot of money that is finite. Some of that money does get printed. Some of it gets raised in taxes, but it's a finite amount of money. And if we spend $1 trillion on defense, we are not going to be able to spend money on child education, on education generally, on child daycare, on health care. Things that really matter. And, you know, the rest of the world, the developed countries have squared this circle, and they've figured out that...
Yeah, they cut back on the NATO allies.
Yeah.
The thing Trump was saying to them is, hey, you got to increase your spending. They made conscious decisions decades ago. We only have a finite amount of money. We're going to spend it not all on military defense. And they cut back.
Well, and we would assert that it's because we were providing them with the nuclear umbrella. We were. But we wanted it that way. We didn't want the European countries to be heavily armed and able to fight with one another. That's the way the contagion of war started, World War I and World War II. But No. The fact is that a lot of what we spend money on now is just the tension of Cold War that we fanned. We fanned it so that it was always the embers were red. They weren't flaming, but they were always red enough to justify the huge expenditure. And it's just an unrealistic. We are spending money planning for the ability to carry out military.
Activities,
military activities, three fronts of warfare. Why? What is the American interest? If we go to war over Taiwan, we'd have to ask ourselves very carefully, why did we do that? And because it will, doing the same thing for Taiwan that we're doing for Ukraine against a country like China will have immense costs associated with it, collateral and direct.
So, you know, when you hear that we want to be able to battle on three fronts, what the American people should be asking is, why?
Why?
Why would you? And then don't say to me that people hate us because of our freedoms. That's not an acceptable answer for what it is you're asking of the American people to make sacrifices for, right? I mean, you're asking the American people to sacrifice the futures of their families. In essence, that's what you are. And you're supposed to say, well, we're doing that because. The next question should be, because of what?
Yes, and you know, the notion that, for instance, America's freedoms directly would be affected, or that European freedoms were. The European alliance, standing alone, is actually a very powerful entity. It has all the potential power of the United States. It's a huge economy, and it's a huge and highly developed population base. You know, the notion that there's going to be something like a Pearl Harbor to affect the United States. The only reason during the Cold War that Russia would have ever sent missiles to the United States is because they believed we had pushed the button and were already sending missiles to Russia. They were not going to take America out with a missile attack if they didn't fear that America had the impulse to do that first.
You know, Sandy, I would say to those in the listening audience, we've got to open our eyes. We've got to be vigilant, even during all these elections, and not get caught up in my enemy is a person who is a fellow American, and so what's in the best interest of this nation should be what's in the best interest of us all. And I don't know why that is such a difficult proposition, Sandy, for people to understand.
I think it's because we've allowed guns and our defense budget and several of these other issues to be third rails about which there can be no lively political discussion or debate. And the most troublesome one, I mean, guns are exceedingly troublesome, but really the most troublesome one is this question of defense and foreign policy, because until we see what's happening in something like Ukraine, it's hard to realize the huge and significant importance what we do with our defense budget has until we have a debate or an analysis about child daycare. And we realize that the reason we can't spend money on these things is because we're spending so much money on our defense. That's the stuff that ought to wake America up and ought to get us to talk about all these issues.
All right, we got to go. I want to thank everybody who made the show go. Sandy, thank you as always. Sam, thank you. Thanks to the listeners. Thanks to the callers. I'll be back on Monday. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.